The decision was made a long time ago. People with mental, intellectual, and developmental challenges would no longer be put away in large institutions, places like mental hospitals and training schools that had become essentially warehouses for the different. So we've been working for decades to reduce the institutions in size and close them in some cases and bring their clients into their communities. That's the work Medford-based Living Opportunities does and has been doing for decades now. And there's an additional push lately to get people with intellectual and developmental disabilities out of the so-called sheltered workshops. To talk about all of this, we are joined today by Roger Hassenpflug, who is the CEO at Living Opportunities and has been since 1988. Roger, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Tell us a bit about how Living Opportunities got started and what the initial purpose was, and if that's changed much over time.
Sure. Well, it got started about the time community services came into existence in the mid-1970s. Prior to that time, families had the kind of dilemma of choosing to keep a child at home without any supports at all or placing their child in a state institution. And changes in Medicaid laws and advocacy on the part of parents created the opportunity to create community-based services all around the country. And when that happened, Living Opportunities, along with probably thousands of organizations at the same time came into existence about 73, 74, 75. There were literally thousands that came into existence all over the country, specifically to provide options for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in local communities.
But this was of a piece, wasn't it, with the general trend in deinstitutionalizing for people with mental health issues as well?
Exactly. And that's really what the advocacy on the part of parents and leading advocates, university advocates around the country was really all about, was creating options so that people wouldn't have to send their kids to state institutions.
But it seems like then that since the whole trend toward community-based services came about, there's been a fair amount of attention represented by Living Opportunities to services for intellectual and developmental disabilities, as opposed to straight mental health services.
Right.
Where Living Opportunities people are seemingly well cared for, but you got a lot of people on the streets who are seeking services for mental health and not getting them.
Yeah, interestingly enough, it's two very separate systems, and I'm not sure why they developed that way, but fortunately for the folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, they have pretty good services have been developed over time. So,
and so what's the general client load at Living Opportunities? How many people do you serve at any given time?
2 years ago, we served a tad over 300. This last year, we served just over 370. Some of those are in traditional kind of group homes. I think 23 people, that's how the organization started in 74. But most of our work now is in supported living. We serve over 70 people in that part of our organization, about 120 people in employment services. And then we also have a consulting arm called Samita Consulting that does regional consultation with families and other organizations like ours with a goal of resolving behavior problem issues and doing some training that would allow kids to stay in their family homes.
You said supported living is what does that term mean?
Sure. Well, supported living is the kind of thing I wish I had when I moved out of my house when I was 19, 20 years old. Essentially, in a group home, five people live together and you have staff 24 hours a day. Contrast that to supported living. People get to choose where they want to live, get to choose whether or not they're going to have a roommate. And then we figure out how to support them so that they can be safe, happy, healthy in that environment. And typically services revolve around what I'd call the three M's, meals, medication, and money, because they're complicated. All of them are complicated issues. We want to help people, have good diets, so teaching cooking skills and, food storage so people don't eat fuzzy food and stuff like that. So
I think I remember the first time I did a story about Living Opportunities many, many, many years ago. Mm. And I was talking to one of the clients who had been previously at Fairview. Mm. And is Fairview even open anymore?
No, it's not. It was closed in 2000. And Oregon was one of the very first states in the country to close their largest public institutions. They had a small one that was open in eastern Oregon until about, I'm going to guess, 2010 or so. But I think there are now 13 states that have closed their public institutions.
So no more training. I remember training schools, too. My mother worked
right
in one in Connecticut.
That's exactly what they were called. They were called hospitals and training centers.
Okay. Much more to talk about with Roger Hassenpflug about the care and growth of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities through his organization, Living Opportunities. And we'll talk about the sheltered workshops issue and how things are progressing with that in Oregon. Living Opportunities leading the way on that. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return. Roger Hassenpflug and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Roger Hassenpflug. He's the CEO at Medford-based Living Opportunities, which tries to provide exactly what its name implies for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and is a leader in this in a lot of ways across the state of Oregon. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about mainstreaming people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, bringing them into society and changing the way we used to do things, which is to push them off into training centers and state hospitals and things like that. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'm not trying to get too far outside your zone of knowledge here, but you mentioned that Oregon's one of the first states to close down some of its major institutions.
Yep.
Is there still some lag? I mean, are there some states where there's still a fairly centralized attention to mental health in one track and intellectual developmental disabilities in the other?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, most of the states in this country still have large state institutions. I mean, there's an effort nationally to reduce the number of people and divert people from going into state institutions by diverting them into community services, but there are still large institutions and many people that still live there.
So we've talked about you find places for people to live, find places for people to work. Has the mission of Living Opportunities transformed at all over the years since you've been CEO? Or I mean, has the mission enhanced at all, I suppose?
Yeah, I think enhanced probably is a way to look at it. I think from the very beginning, the idea was to create community-based services for people so they could just have the same kind of life you and I have. But certainly the original idea was to provide 24-hour supervised living, and the assumptions at the very beginning, for example, were that people couldn't work, and we had universities do demonstration projects that proved that you could pull people off the back wards of institutions and teach them work skills. And as soon as that happened, the bright light came on, and we started creating things called sheltered workshops and work activity centers. And again, the original idea was that okay, people could work, but they can't really do the same kind of work that everybody else does in a regular business.
And you've proven that wrong time and time and time again.
We're working
you?
Very hard to change that perception, yes.
You're very, very diplomatic, aren't you? So let's talk about sheltered workshops,
sure.
Because that is currently one of the major things you're focused on, getting people out of, I mean, I want to say the last of them. Have they been reduced in number, as have training schools and state hospitals over the years?
Yeah, I wish that were true. Actually, there was a big push in the 1980s, early 1990s to develop what was called supported employment, which basically is a regular job in a local business all around the country. And it kind of died, for, I guess, lack of urgency, other types of crises, competition for public funding, et cetera. And now we're seeing another resurgence of that. We bought into it at the very beginning in the late 1980s and have never stopped. So essentially, we now have about 120 people working for right at 70 different businesses in Jackson County. And we've done that inside a system that's really meant to support and fund segregated services in sheltered workshops.
So it looks like it's about a 2-to-1 ratio of people who are working, clients who are working versus clients who are not?
Well,
1-to-2, I guess. A 2-to-1, not working.
Okay.
All right, you said 370 plus, basically.
Yeah.
And I'm just counting 120 people working at 70 businesses. So that implies there are 250 or so not working.
Actually, those are the 370 people we served are in different kinds of services. So literally every person that we serve in employment is working or in the process of searching for a job right now. So we don't have facilities or sheltered workshops anywhere at this point.
And so where do the people work? I mean, what are some of the jobs? I remember years ago, I think, again, it was one of the first stories I did about living opportunities. I ran into a crew that was doing maintenance landscaping work for the city of Medford.
Yep, that's how we started. The original model was, they were called crews and enclaves, essentially. So a crew work would be yard maintenance. And we still do some of that. We have two yard crews, and we have one small janitorial crew. And then we also have some group placements. Derek's Corporation right here in Ashland, for example. SOU hires a number of people. Yerba Prima in Ashland hires a group of people. And I think we've been in Derek's now for 15-plus years, so quite a long time. And they actually had a commitment as far back as 30 years ago. They hired a guy by the name of Philip in the early 1980s. So they're very much a leader in this type of service.
Is there a constant outreach to try to get new employers to buy into the living opportunities concept?
Absolutely, and I think it's one of the things that's kind of transformed our organization over the last 10 or 12 years is our effort to really integrate our organization into the community. It was kind of an interesting irony that we always hoped for and expected, you know, full inclusion for folks with disabilities, and then kind of as an organization stayed quietly in the background. And what we learned is that we couldn't develop enough jobs fast enough for people with that kind of strategy. So we've really worked very hard to get the organization out and connected to our community. And yes, it's very much a constant effort.
Is there a sort of trial period? I mean, do you sign contracts with employers and say, let's give this a 6-month, 1-year try, whatever, and then we'll see how you like it after that time or something like that?
Yeah, not so much a contract like that. We work very hard to make it a win-win situation for the employer. So we do an assessment. We have a community-based assessment process that helps us learn a lot about folks with disabilities before we set them into a job. And we try very hard to develop jobs that match their interests, their abilities, et cetera. And if for whatever reason that turns out to not be the case, we help the business replace the person and find a person that will work for them and find a different job for the person that particular job didn't work out for.
And what are usually the skills that are best able to be employed?
Well, you know, 25 years ago, we thought people were restricted to things like packaging and assembly and very light kind of janitorial work.
Manual kinds of things.
Now we're finding that the more opportunities and experiences we can share with people, the more skills they develop. It should be no shock, you know, that's true for all of us. And so now we have a wide range. I mean, we've got 8 different people working for the Grange Co-op, for example, and 8 different stores, and they do everything from data entry and office work to, you know, things that would typically happen in a feed store in a warehouse area, shelving, just all kinds of things. It's a very wide range.
So is there some sort of is there a subsidy that comes with the worker who comes through Living Opportunities? I mean, is there some financial benefit to the employer in addition to the feeling of, hey, we've done this?
It's possible. Those kinds of subsidies do exist. We typically don't use them. Unfortunately, we found early on in the process that there are some employers that would employ somebody for the length of the subsidy and then stop the employment at the end of the subsidy. So we really work to find employers that are committed to making this work from day one.
And you said 70 different businesses then on a regular basis. And is that fairly stable set of 70 businesses? Or?
No, it's the work world. So it ebbs and flows on a pretty consistent basis. I usually say, well, it's around 70 because it may have changed this morning and I didn't know it. You know, so sometimes it goes down. Things happen. You know, businesses sometimes go out of business in the worst case scenario, but they have differing production needs. And then we add businesses, you know, constantly. So.
Roger Hassenflug is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the CEO of Medford-based Living Opportunities, which has been working for 40 years now, come to think of it, to mainstream people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, to get them into society, get them living in society, working in society. And it is also leading the way on a move to close down the last of the sheltered workshops in the state of Oregon with the help of other organizations that it is training. We'll get to that in a moment. You can join us on the Exchange with questions or comments about the processes and the general approaches and general philosophy employed here. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned no sheltered workshops in your general zone of influence?
Well, no, just for our organization.
Your organization, okay.
We do have things that would be characterized as sheltered workshops in Jackson County and Southern Oregon, certainly. In fact, it's still the most common way people have work with these types of disabilities all around the country.
It's a term we have heard a lot over the years. What does it mean, though, sheltered workshop?
Well, the original idea, of course, was to protect, and I think that's kind of what the word sheltered means, is to protect folks from something. As it turns out, you know, in retrospect, looking at the long history of it, what we're protecting them from is the rest of us out here in our community, which they don't need that much protection from. It was also assumed, 25 years ago, that folks could only work very slowly, do very minimal kinds of production. And again, the more opportunity we've created for folks to learn skills and increase their ability to not only do a wide variety of tasks, but to be just as productive as other people in their workplace, there's less and less reason to have sheltered workshops. And frankly, the national debate around sheltered workshops and other related issues should really be around segregation, because that's really the bottom line. That's what it's about.
I notice I ended up using the word myself, segregation, in writing up the information about this segment, because that really is what it is. You're saying, okay, these people don't get to work with everybody else. They have to work over here.
Right. Exactly. That was the, originally I assume that institutions were a good idea. We were trying to protect folks and do the best thing we thought, the thing we thought was right at that point in time. But again, in retrospect, what it did was separate people from their families and their communities by long distances and months at a time. And that wasn't a good idea in the end.
So Oregon, as I understand, has embarked upon an effort to do away with the last of the sheltered workshops?
Yes. In about 2008, they established a policy called Employment First. It's a national movement, actually. And the idea is that the first choice would be a job, and the benchmark in terms of measuring or comparing what's going on currently to the ideal would be an individual job in a business where the business paid the person had access to the usual kind of benefits and holidays and whatnot that every other employer had, and would earn a commensurate wage for that.
But in Oregon in particular, there is, I understand, a governor's executive order of last year sometime?
Yes. In April 2013, Governor Kitzhaber issued Executive Order 13-04. And again, the idea is to push forward the notion of supported employment and to create real outcomes for people. So not only did he issue a governor's order, but stuck a bunch of money in the budget to help move this idea forward and create jobs for people all across the state of Oregon.
And so Living Opportunities ends up right smack in the middle of this, because it's the kind of thing you've always been doing.
Right. We've done it for 25-plus years. And actually, we just kicked off in June an Employment Learning Collaborative with five other organizations, and which came out of, I guess, a little bit of frustration, wanting things to actually happen. We were driving back from a large group training and thought, how could we convince the state to really put some, money into the system and really help people get the help organizations really get the kind of skills they need to make this happen. And by the time we got home to Medford, that had all changed to why can't we do that? So we put the idea together, pitched it to a local foundation, the Oregon Community Foundation, and then also pitched it to the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services in Oregon, and both of them agreed to fund it. And together we were able to launch the Employment Learning Collaborative, which includes five other organizations from all around the state.
Are you from Eugene, Monmouth, Grants Pass, St. Helens, and Troutdale, I notice?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so essentially, are you training the trainers with the Employment Learning Collaborative?
That's the idea, is to help organizations learn how to do four basic things. One is assessment and discovery for people, because most people with these types of disabilities have very limited job experiences. And if you ask them what they want to do, they'll say that they want to, wash dishes or sweep floors, because that's the only experience they've had. So that assessment process opens up kind of blows the lid off that idea and shows people that there are a lot of different options. So we try to teach that assessment and discovery process, then job development that follows the assessment so that people get good job matches, jobs that they can be successful at. And then the next phase is the initial job training, setup, and natural support development, which I could explain in a minute, and then finally ongoing support, because once we develop a job with a business, we don't go away.
That's an important component, and I have noticed this in the workings of Living Opportunities because, for example, some of the janitorial work went on at a place I used to work. And so there's always help nearby, if
right.
not, in fact, there all the time.
Right. Even in the situations where a business might decide that they're going to supervise the person directly, we stay involved. So we stay connected to that business. They can call us. The job tasks might change. They might need help, one of our job coaches to come back in and reteach different kinds of job tasks. The job may change altogether. Technology may replace the job that the person originally had, and they've got an idea for a different job. So we can come in and reteach that job. If there are issues or problems or whatever they might be, we're there to come back in and help solve them, including the thing we talked about earlier, which is if the job doesn't work out for that person, helping the business find a different person, and then helping the person who didn't make it at that job find a different job that they can be successful at.
I'm fascinated by the assessment part of this. And in fact, you probably see upside down here, the big word assessment here is that how detailed a process is that? How long, how in-depth, and does it involve multiple people?
It's about 4 to 5 weeks long. It's specifically focused on employment. And what we do is we bring a person in. We do the usual kinds of things that you would think we would do, which is interview them in terms of their interests and skill level and their past experience. We might talk to their parents. We might talk to teachers, etc. But the next step is showing them, probably in the neighborhood of 200 slides of different job tasks in a wide variety of businesses so that they get the impression that there really are lots of choices. And from that experience, they get to choose 5 to 8 jobs that they want to try out. And we've got about 35 or so businesses locally. Many of them already employ people with disabilities. Some of them just allow us to come in and do assessments at their site. So we've got about 35 different businesses, and they could choose to have experiences at any one of those businesses. And then we have a job coach go with them, and we learn about all kinds of things while they're doing some job tasks at that business. We learn about the physical environment, the social environment, how people relate to each other, what kind of tasks they can do, whether or not they can read, whether or not they can tell time, how we're going to have to accommodate it. For example, if a person can't count, and one of the things that they have to do is count, there's a couple of different simple ways to accommodate that. You could create a piece of cardboard on a table with 8 boxes on it, and when they fill each box with the widget that they're supposed to count and put together, and then they've got a whole package. Another way to do it is to weigh things. If there's a certain amount of screws that have to go into a package, you can weigh it instead of count the screws. So we figure out those accommodations in the assessment process. And we figure out the person's learning style. You know, are they verbal learners? Do they need picture cues? Whatever it might be. And that helps us not only match the job, but then teach the job at the very beginning.
Wow. So that's a very, very detailed process.
It is. Actually, it's pretty sophisticated.
Do you ever get a situation where you've gone through the 5 or 8 jobs that somebody's interested in doing and they're not particularly good at any of them? I mean, what then?
We restart the process. You know, there's something they're good at. They want to work. So there's something they're good at. So we'll figure it out.
We're talking about getting people with intellectual and developmental disabilities mainstreamed in work, in life, in the community, which is the job of Living Opportunities, which is involved, as you heard, in something else right now involving the Employment Learning Collaborative, letting other organizations around the state learn how to get people doing exactly what Living Opportunities is doing. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange, or take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back with Roger Hassenpflug and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Roger Hassenpflug. He's the CEO at Living Opportunities based in Medford, which for the last 40 years has been working to mainstream people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, to put them into housing, to put them into jobs, to have them live lives alongside the rest of us in society, which is a far cry from the way we used to deal with people with such disabilities, because they used to be sent off to training schools and state hospitals and places like that. As the whole system has changed, Living Opportunities has grown in importance and is now teaching other people how to do what it does. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the mission, the work, and the training. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So I'm curious now, when we talk about 370 or so clients at Living Opportunities, how big a staff? Because when you talk about, for example, 4 or 5 weeks of assessment to get somebody geared up for a job, this is not only a lengthy process that's going to involve probably several people, but some specialized skills, too, and some great patience, I would think, too, among the trainers and assessors.
Sure. Actually, it depends on which part of our organization you're talking about. Some of it's very staff intensive. For example, if you're providing 24-hour support, I think we've got 60-plus staff, about 60 or so staff that just serve 23 people. But contrast that with, 28 staff serving 70 people in supported living, and 25 staff, for certainly less than 30 staff, serving 120 people in employment. So part of it's creating natural supports. I kind of talked a little bit about that earlier, mentioned it earlier without explaining what it was. And that's really just having, in a business situation, having the folks that are typically in that business provide that support, and fading our staff time so that we can use our sometimes rather precious staff time to go on and help somebody else.
Well, in that case, do you end up training some of the other workers at a business and saying, okay, when the situations arise like this, here's what you do?
Exactly. And I think many times, if folks haven't had experience with people with these types of disabilities, there's an assumption that there's some trick, to interacting with them or what have you. And we have to help people kind of get over that concern that they might do something wrong or say the wrong thing, etc. So during the job setup process, we typically do quite a bit of training with other supporters in that environment, just to kind of help them get over that hump so they can see that the person that they're going to work with is just like anybody else. So.
Have you found a sweet spot in staff size for where Living Opportunities clients are placed in jobs? I mean, are they best in a medium-sized office, small office with a fairly close environment?
Not so much that, I think, but certainly we have evolved over the years. Initially, when we started doing this, we were looking for jobs that had high turnover, for example. And what we found over time is that that's exactly where we don't want to be. We want to be in businesses that are typically locally owned, or at least have enough local control that you've got decision makers that we can have access to, because those decision makers have to make a commitment to having a person with disabilities working on their staff. That's the key to, I think, making it work. And the other thing is having businesses that are well run and have good staff morale, the kind of businesses that anybody would want to work for. Those are the kinds of businesses we're looking for. And they could be very small 2- and 3-person shops. They could be large businesses like Blackstone Audio or Southern Oregon University or the Grange Co-op or hospitals, anything.
So in the process of assessing what the client can do, I mean, do you do a similar sort of process just of figuring out what the business is like?
And absolutely.
So, I mean, have you ever said, this isn't really going to work?
Yes, we have. And occasionally usually it's before we get somebody placed, and we can just kind of tell from the environment, either the physical environment, maybe it's just not going to work for the person because it's a place that's too cold or too warm or too noisy, or there's too many lights, there are too many lights, etc. But sometimes it's been after we've had a person placed there and it just wasn't working.
Let's take a call. You need your headphones on for this. So let's go to Priscilla in Neyland, California, if I can get the button pushed. There we go. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Roger Hassenpflug from Living Opportunities.
Hi. I was wondering how a pay scale is set for a person who's in that situation. That I remember there was one time at which people were getting paid piecework. They'd do some sort of a test and decide what, how comparable disabled person's work was to a non-impaired person's work. And then they pay them that, but then it got to be, a complaint of using people as basically very cheap labor. Mm-hmm. And then, but if you pay somebody a lot, you know, who can do less than somebody else, maybe you'll be overpaying them. So how do they strike that down?
Sure. I think when employment started in the mid-1970s, at the beginning, again, the assumption was that folks couldn't work at all. So there was an effort to create what was called a subminimum wage. And you're correct when you say that it's kind of based on a piece rate. So subminimum wage is set up. There are rules around it. The Department of Labor has very specific rules controlling it. An organization like ours might do multiple time studies, compare the time it took the person with disabilities to do the work, and then convert all that into an hourly wage that was less than the minimum wage. That is a national debate all over the country. I can tell you that most people in the United States still, if they work, they get paid a subminimum wage. Our commitment, we decided to change that in about the year 2007, and almost, but not quite, every single job we've developed since 2007 has been at minimum wage or better. And I just looked at the data for the year, the last 4 years actually, ending in June 30th, 2013, yesterday, and we're at 97.4%, I think, of we're certainly over 90% of that folks that we work with who get paid minimum wage or better, and we're committed to marching toward 100%. And the reason we aren't at 100% is that we don't always have control. We may have been in a business for 15 years, and the original deal that we cut with the employer was that folks would be paid at subminimum wage. So we're working to change those things, and we're pretty close to 100% success.
How subminimum wage? How far below?
You know, I've heard of people getting paid as little as 40 cents an hour, which is almost tragic. And there are certainly examples, and you've seen, I'm sure, exposés on 60 Minutes and whatnot. There have been examples where that's been horribly abused around the country. I think in general, it's not abused in that way where people are, taking that, advantage of it, that significant a level. But certainly I think we need to move away from subminimum wages. I mean, that's just...
So you're shooting for a minimum wage or better, and got there more than 90% at this point.
Yeah.
Does the money get paid directly to the client, or is it sometimes handled by Living Opportunities and put into accounts for them, put for their behalf? I mean, how does that all work?
Oh, actually, the person with disabilities gets the money unless there's an arrangement for them not to, like they have a guardian or a conservator. In terms of how we set up jobs with businesses, sometimes we set them up where Living Opportunities is an intermediary. So it's a little bit like a temp business where the employer would pay us the wage, and then we in turn were a flow-through, in effect, to the person with disabilities in that situation. Other times, employers hire directly. And the reason we do the kind of temp service model occasionally is that sometimes a barrier to employment is that an employer might be concerned about workers' compensation issues, for example, people getting hurt on the job. We know from our data that folks with disabilities are actually less likely to get hurt on the job than our other employees, so it doesn't bother us at all to take that risk. So if it's a difference between a person getting the job they want or not getting the job they want, and all we have to do to make it work is have the business pay us and we pay the person with disabilities, we'll do that.
Here is another call. Let's talk to Wayne in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Roger Hassenflug, who's the CEO at Living Opportunities, based in Medford.
Hi. My name's Wayne, and I've got a manufacturing company. We make raised garden beds and introducing a line of bird feeders and nest boxes and bat houses and things like that maybe... I have excess production capacity of parts, and I'm just getting into marketing product, and I expect that I'll have excess parts production capacity, but not capital to hire a lot of people until I get my marketing going. So I'm thinking is it possible that I could give you kits of parts and you could assemble, let the people be in business for themselves? I give you credit, you get parts, and you sell the product, you give me some of the money, and they're in business. You know, you send them, set them up at the craft shows, and they can ask whatever they want for the product that they built.
So you're proposing to do the work off-site, though, not at your facility?
Exactly, yeah.
All right, let's see what Roger has to say about that. And if you want to follow through, make sure to contact Living Opportunities directly. What do you say, Roger? How might that work, Roger?
Yeah, we don't do a lot of self-employment like that, but that is a trend around the country. There are people that get set up in their own businesses. We'd certainly be happy to take a look at it and talk to Wayne about it. It would have to be a situation where the person would probably assemble them at their house, because we're not going to bring them into a facility to have them do that. That's exactly the opposite of what we want to do. So we'd either want to have the person assemble them at home and have it really be a self-employed business, or assemble them at some business that Wayne owns to make that work.
Are there some people self-employed through clients of Living Opportunities?
We've dabbled with it a couple of times. We haven't had a lot of success. It's not something we've been particularly good at making work, but that is a model that does work and has worked for people, a few people in the Rogue Valley and certainly around the country.
So back to the Employment Learning Collaborative, where you're essentially training the trainers in other parts of the state of Oregon. At this point, it's just five different organizations that you're working with.
Uh-huh.
How long is that process then?
It's about an 18-month process. It might stretch out to 2 years. It kind of depends a little bit on the grant funding and the organizations that are involved in the collaborative and what they want. But the difference between the typical kind of training situation where a group of people come together and listen to, you know, lecture type training and then maybe try to do some group activities or whatnot. This is a very hands-on training. We have some of that group training where we share concepts and so forth, but the real difference maker in the kind of training that we're talking about is we go to their sites and help them do the things that they need to do to be successful in their communities. So they might not totally adopt what we do necessarily. We've, for job development, for example, we've probably used a half a dozen different strategies and scenarios over the years, all the typical ones, to get to the point where we are the one that we use currently. I think we're very capable of consulting with them around any of those strategies if they choose a different one than the one we're using currently.
So with the governor's executive order of last year, is there a deadline given by which date sheltered workshops in the state of Oregon should be closed?
Well, there's a front door closure, and I didn't memorize the date, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but it's 2 or 3 years down the road. And what it does is it shuts the front door to sheltered workshops so that they can't let any more people in after a certain date. And that's a very long-term strategy for closing shelter workshops. That means that anybody who's in one can stay in one, and they can stay in one for the rest of their working life.
Given that you've been working for so long in a non-sheltered workshop sort of situation, is it surprising to you that some have held on so long? And has Living Opportunities been doing any proselytizing or trying to convince the rest of the state of Oregon to do what you're doing?
You know, I think until we did this learning collaborative, we didn't do any of that. We just paid attention to our business and kind of kept our head down and kept working at it. It was a struggle because we were trying to make it work inside a system that was funded for very segregated work, which is a less expensive service model, at least on the front end. On the back end, it's actually a more expensive model because you never are able to fade your staff from a setting like that. Whereas in a community-based job, many times you can set up the job, fade your staff, and really the expense goes down to almost zero except for the fact that we check in with an employer periodically.
And by fade your staff, you mean they just don't have to be there anymore.
Right.
Once the training
there.
Is complete,
right.
They're out of there.
Exactly.
I understand that, two questions, actually. First of it is about funding, because you've mentioned grants a couple times. I'm going to guess those are probably pivotal to the operation and success of Living Opportunities.
Up to a point, about 80% of our funding comes from it's state and federal funds mixed at the state level and passed through to us. And the reason we get so much public money like that is that we are the alternative to state institutions. I mean, an organization like ours, it's not just Living Opportunities, but all of the community-based organizations are the alternative to state state institutions. So they took the money that they used to spend on institutions and they spent it on community services. But 20% of our $7 million budget is still a lot of money, and that's leveraged through business activities, fundraising, grants, and so forth.
And I guess the final question is, then I understand you're moving toward retirement. When's that going to happen?
I am at the end of 2015, probably December 31st, 2015. Kind of looking forward to it, actually.
You mentioned fishing during one of our breaks, we'll see you with a poll down the road.
Right.
And hope to see you before then as well. Still talking about Living Opportunities. Roger Hassenpflug is the CEO at Living Opportunities, based in Medford. Thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks for having us.